Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Bowhunter Chronicles podcast brought to you by Tacticam. Tacticam is by far the easiest way to begin filming your hunts. Whether it's the budget-friendly solo or the 4K 5.0, Tacticam has something for everyone. Check them out at tacticam.com. This year we're also partnered with Spartan Forge. Spartan Forge is military artificial intelligence for the deer woods. Basically, what they're doing is using collared deer studies and millions, if not billions, of data points to predict when and where the deer are going to move based on moon, weather, wind, all of those types of things to save your precious time. So we all don't have that much time, you know, to just go out with families and everything like that. So basically, Spartan Forge gives you an opportunity to look ahead of time and say, this is where the deer are going to be. This is how they're moving. Really great information. It's just another tool. I hate the tool in your toolbox type thing because I just think that that's a little bit too cliche. But it's also mapping software. So one of the things we've been talking about within our Patreon group lately is like the actual deer, like tracking, like your track when you're going in using your mapping software. One of the cool things about Spartan Forge is it has like real time turn by turn. And we've talked about this with Ed from Basemap. We talked about it a few different times. Spartan Forge is a series of a whole bunch of dots that show exactly where you have been. And it's really, really pretty cool. It doesn't take any shortcuts and just create the lines. You'll have to check it out. It is back available on the App Store and Google Play. It was in beta, and now they've taken the information from those beta testers, the guys that got in and have kind of, they're working out the bugs, and they've got it up. So you can check that out at spartanforge.ai. And one of the other things that I really like about it, I've got it written down here, is that it's got 5 different maps. So different satellite images for different times of the year, right built into the app. So no more going from, while you're in the field, you're able to kind of do some of the stuff that you may have done on the computer. So being able to switch and see what that tree looks like at this time of year, what that swamp looks like. Is that cattails? Is it grass? What is it? Looking at deer trails. One of the other features that I really like about it. So you can check them out at spartanforge.ai, or now you can check them out. You know, just go to the iTunes or wherever, I don't know what's called, Apple Store or the Play Store. So check them out. This week's podcast, we're talking with Jared Van Hees from the Habitat podcast. Jared killed a really nice, I think he said it was like 130-some-inch buck early in October, and tried to get him on. He was going to be in Ohio hunting. I was in Wisconsin. In the interim, he ended up leaving Ohio, went home because the trail cameras were hitting, and killed another buck. So he's tagged out in Michigan, And I think I joke about it in the podcast, like about with 400 inches of Michigan whitetail, but I think it's like 270, something like that. He killed another very similar buck. I think they're both 9 points, scoring somewhere in the neighborhood of 130, 135 inch deer off of 15 acres. And we talk about why he picked that 15 acres, how he's got it set up, and the things that help that little piece of property to be successful, and kind of like what we can do if we've got that little home piece and we want to maximize the deer that are on there. Really informative, fun, very nice, like seamless podcast. Want to do some quick shout outs before we get into it. John O'Bannon, Alex Blue, and Matt, who went on the elk hunt. You heard about him in that Colorado elk hunt. They all harvested deer over this past week. Matt, he's the one who hit the elk, didn't find it, missed it. I know he's sure going to love me reiterating that, but they all shot deer this week. And then the guys are releasing more arrows over there, Robbie and the boys at Knox and Hooks Outdoors. You need to go check them out on Instagram or wherever. But yeah, they're all within our Patreon group, and Patreon is crowdfunding for creators, right? So basically that helps me to be able to pay the bills. So the hosting, paying for music, paying for all the things, the costs incurred with the podcast, and then we try and give back as much as we can. Spartan Ford, Zinger Fletchings, they all donate. We have giveaways from them, from Tacticam. I think it's going to be another one of the solo packages for this fourth quarter. So Tacticam solo package. And then we use whatever money that we've got left over, whatever we can throw at the podcast. And we're going to do a podcast here coming up because it seems to be one of the questions that we get the most, or that we see posted a lot, is like saddle hunting, what's the best pack? So I want to give away a couple of packs. I think we're going to give away one of the new Badlands packs that Alex was talking about on the last Latitude podcast, as well as one of the Everly Stock X2s. So I think we're going to give one of those away. And then I want to give away a trophy line pack, and we will do that here pretty soon. I just need to make sure that they're going to be available. That's the only thing. But we're going to go through some of those packs, John and I, what we've used. When John's been using the K's pack as well as the Everly Stock X2, I was using the Plateau pack from Trophy Line, as well as the my Badlands Super Day pack. And that has, it's that's okay, but the new one that Alex was talking about, Badlands really kind of stepped it up there, and I want to check that pack out, so I'm going to buy one to check out and then give away. And so if you guys want to check that out, you can go to patreon.com/Bowhunter Chronicles Podcast. Links are on our website, bowhunterchroniclespodcast.com, or on Instagram in the link tree up there. But if Patreon's not for you, no big deal. We appreciate everyone listening. And, you know, just do us a favor. Leave us a review on iTunes. Tell us what we're doing right. Tell us what we're doing wrong. Tell me that I'm saying too much. I'm still waiting for an email. Christographer, I got a shirt and some stuff ready for you. Just shoot me an email, adam@bowhunterchroniclespodcast.com, and I'll get that sent out to you when I send out the swag packs for all the new Patreons. But if not, just tell a friend. Tell somebody else, like, that might have, for this podcast, that might have 10 acres and they've been trying to do food plots, they've been trying to manage their deer and it's just not helping, or they're not seeing the results that they want, tell them to check it out. We really appreciate it. And I think you guys are going to like this one. It was a fun episode for me. Enjoy the episode. Thanks for listening. All right, everybody. Adam back with another episode of the Bowhunter Chronicles podcast. I was going to have John here, but my wife decided that she wanted to go ahead and catch COVID. So she's upstairs. And I got tested today. I was negative, but it's some sort of a miracle, divine intervention of sorts. But yeah, so it's just me talking with the Habitat podcast, Jared Van Hees, who has had an incredible season this year on his 15-acre private piece set up strictly for deer hunting. And we're going to try and unwrap that and figure out, you know, how do you do that? And I haven't seen anything that says these deer scored this. I'm sure we'll get into that. And like the title of the podcast is going to be like 400 inches of deer off 15 acres in Michigan, or half that or something. But these aren't two spikes or anything. These are two really respectable deer. I think no matter where you hunt, and everything that Jared's put into this, I don't think anybody can discount, and you could hardly look for a better outcome, I would say. So Jared, how are you doing this evening, and how was that that lead up? What do you think?
I think you knocked it out of the park, bud. I appreciate it. I'm doing great. If you see me drinking a beer or two over here, it's because I'm still celebrating. And you know, good to see you again. It's been a while. Last time I think we actually got to hang out together was up at TAC. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a while, man. You look good. Glad you're healthy and good. I also had the VID a little while back, got through that right before hunting season, and been good, been busy. Some kid sicknesses and stuff going around. We've just been, it's been an unreal last 5 or 6 weeks, but God is good. I'm blessed. We're doing well. And yeah, happy to talk to you. Very pumped up. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So for people that aren't familiar with you or the Habitat podcast or your YouTube channel or any of the things that you've been doing, you know, let's give us a little rundown. Like, what's your hunting history? Who are you? What are you doing?
Sure. No, thank you. Jared Van Hees. I am 34, Michigan resident, lived here my whole life. Grew up in Grand Haven, not far down the road from where you're at. Hunted growing up in Hesperia, shot my first buck in Hesperia on state land, again, right down the road from where you're at. I feel like we can commiserate together on a lot of things. I really got serious about hunting in college, went to Central Michigan, and there are a lot of deer up that way, and I really learned what not to do in those 5 years at college there, and the extra year. And after that, it's been really kind of an uphill, just hike up the mountain, if you will, just really getting into more challenging stuff, challenging myself, and just getting more obsessed down this rabbit hole. If you ask my wife, I'm sure she could tell you all about it. And it's been fun. I mainly like to bow hunt, but I gun hunt, I muzzleloader hunt, I go out of state, I do it all. I duck hunt. I'm just a passionate outdoorsman. We camp with the family, fish, all that stuff. But the main thing is whitetails and habitat work. And when I say habitat work, I mean, I like to improve land and make it better for hunting. So you can actually have a say in how your hunting goes, not just have to go find a new spot. You can change that on your own property. And that's where I always thought it was pretty intriguing. So after following along on some websites for a while on that, I started a podcast about it. I bought my own 15 acres about 5 years ago, and it's my fifth season this year. So, and I've been learning ever since. The podcast has been awesome. As you know, we like to podcast. We like to talk about this stuff. It's kind of who we are. And I'm on, let's see, episode 150 something there. All free habitat information, you know, guys who like to food plot, hinge cut, just make your land better. It could be for deer, which is our main focus, bow hunting setups. It could be for turkey, or talk butterfly habitat, upland bird habitat. We've talked about all of it, pond habitat, but the main thing is deer hunting. And we can relate that to private land, public land, whatever type of habitat you need to be focusing on, depending on where you're at, what time of year, going out of state, what to look for, that whole thing. So it's kind of who I am. I have a wife and three kids, twin 7-year-old daughters and a 3-year-old boy. Dog. Yeah. We're busy, man. We live fast over here. So we're just, I'm just had a cup of coffee before we sat down and it's 9 o'clock at night and it's just another day. So keep turning and burning.
For sure. With the, like the habitat stuff, like how did you get into like wanting to go down that road? I think, you know, it's easy to look at, you know, if you still watch any outdoor channel or whatever, you know, you see them out there and they give you the, maybe the 1 minute montage of they go out there with a rake and they do this or they spray and they're riding around on their ATVs and they come back with a tractor and then, you know, it flips ahead 6 months and then there's deer in there and it's knee high clover and all of these things. And it looks so easy. And then when you, I mean, at least for me, like, oh yeah, I'm just going to get some throw and grow and throw it out there. And then nothing happens or it rains a whole lot and washes away all your seed or there's no rain at all. And the birds eat everything and fly away with it. And you're like, well, but the montage showed it just being like this. So how did you get into it? And I guess maybe more importantly, like how did you stick with it?
great question. I think it's a combination of always wanting to own land. And then like, you know, I love to grow things, garden, trees, whatever. So, you know, my family, we never had any of our own private property. I grew up and cut my teeth on state land, Manistee National Forest, and never had private. A friend of mine, was in the Marine Corps, by the way, happy Veterans Day. Thank you for your service. I want to make sure I said that to you tonight. Of course. We really support the veterans. And that is, so my buddy Ruben, he was a Marine Corps scout sniper. We grew up hunting together. He's like my other half when we were kids. We hunt his grandma's 50 acres in Fremont, and that was unreal. The amount of deer, the pressure was low. It was crazy. So I always had this goal in mind, like, hey, I want to own something someday, have my own cabin, bring the family up there, family camp, you know, all that. So that's kind of where it started. I started watching, QDMA used to have a forum, where it was all habitat stuff and guys would buy their farm. So say, Adam, you bought 40 acres. Here's what it looks like today, 1995 or whatever. And then they'd slowly document as the years went on, all the work they did and take pictures. And then, you know, 3 years later, you have a 50 page forum and you just go, you're just seeing results. And just, it's very neat to watch other people do what I do now. And I was intrigued every night, you know, sitting there on the laptop, just watching these people with their properties all over the country. Well, that kind of got me hooked on the habitat thing. And then I bought 15 acres and I kind of have a terrible memory. So I couldn't remember all the stuff I was reading all the time. So I'm like, you know what? I like podcasts. There's not a habitat podcast out there that I know of. I'll start one. And that way I can interview all these people, remember, go back and listen to it over and over again if I have to. And that's kind of where that started. And then once you start seeing results from the hard work you put in, you start seeing your deer hitting your clover or they're hitting the pinch point that you created with funneling with trees or miscanthus or switchgrass. That's when you're like, okay, I did that right. Awesome. And it gives you like a little boost, right? This little just inkling of I'm doing that right. Okay, I'm doing that right. Oh, they didn't like that. So it's more of like a strategy. My buddy Jake says it's like deer hunting all year round because you can, as soon as the season's over, we're in the woods with chainsaws making deer habitat January 1st. And then, you know, October 1st gets here, you have to set all the tools down and start hunting. And it's kind of like, okay, well, that's done. But then you sit there during hunting season and go, man, I should have done that. I wish I would have done that. So it's just, your mind never stops working. That's probably why I keep going, just because, the results are there, you know?
Okay. So what do you, it's funny because I've said this to multiple people. Obviously, if you listen to the podcast for a while, we hunt mostly public land. My family does have 240 acres up in the UP. The issue is A, it's 7 hours to get there. Mm. Okay. I can, and the hunting is marginal at best. And I can be in Ohio to where there's giants around every corner. You can't even not step on one. And we'll get into your Ohio trip this year to discount that a little bit.
I didn't step on any.
but you know, so to drive up there to put in all of that work, I feel like, and I've said this, and maybe other guys feel the same way, is that I would rather fail on public land than put a whole bunch of work into something and then still fail. You know what I mean? Like, so you've got your dollars, your time, you know, drive time, sweat equity, chainsaw gas, you know, all the things. And then, you know, I guess I'm just not that confident in my ability to keep deer, hold deer. And that's why your story, you know, here is so interesting to me, because like, even when you say like, I want to buy a property, I would like to have a property. You said, okay, from your QDMA forum, you said, Adam, you bought 40 acres. Okay. That would be the quintessential Michigan deer camp. And you have 15 acres. So to go and do that and say, the property that I'm going to hang my hat on, where I'm going to say, this is where I'm going to stake my claim as a habitat manager, as a hunter, is going to be 15 acres. Now, if you were, Lee Lukoski or a Drury, or if you were Jeff Sturgis or something, you know, those guys, I'm sure, would say, I know exactly what I'm going to do and how I'm going to do it and why, and I can make any property because they've done it before. But for someone that's coming at it from the first time, how did you land on 15 acres as, you know, what you were going to use? Why did you choose that property? And you know, how is in your mind, or was in your mind at the time, 15 acres enough property?
No, great point. And I wasn't sure that it was, to be completely honest with you. I could afford it. That was one thing. I walked around a bunch of property. Not a bunch. I cyber scouted a bunch that were for sale listings. This was back in 16, 17. And then I walked probably four or five with a realtor. And I don't know. Wasn't what I wanted. Wasn't clicking. A little high in price. These were 40 acre pieces, you know, 30 acre pieces. This one was this 15 that I bought, you know, it is enough to do stuff on, obviously, which you'll hear later in the show here. But I mean, I still today would rather have 40, 80, 120, right? Like, who wouldn't? But I could afford it at a young family. I pissed the wife off just enough to where I could get it bought. and she let it go. And it was next to a large swamp here in Michigan. That was huge for me. That was one of my main requirements, was cover nearby. And I don't want cover somebody can just go walk through. I want cover. That was one. Requirement two was I wanted my access where I parked my car, where I built my cabin, where I parked my camper, whatever I was going to do in the future. I wanted that to be on the east side. We have predominantly west winds. So to me, that made sense. And then lastly, I wanted it to be in a cooperative. And this one was in the outskirts of a cooperative. The neighbor had a sign up, so all good signs. I walked in the wintertime and saw some sign, the most sign I had seen from all the other properties, but still not very much. And I thought, you know what, let's try it. I'll figure it out. And I'm kind of stubborn or ambitious, or I'm not sure what you want to call it, but I figured, like, if it doesn't work, I'll sell it, right? It's an asset. Land is an asset. It's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to decrease in value. So that's kind of how I looked at it. Did I know what I could do with it to this point at this time? No, to be completely honest. But I didn't know that much about habitat in general back then either. So it's really been my proving grounds, if you will, or my learning experience, as well as a pretty cherry piece of hunting property right now.
And so you buy this piece of property. What is the first thing that you decided that you were going to do? Was it like, I need to put, I mean, oh, all right, so let's step back. Just one.
First thing that everybody wants to do?
I don't have a bonfire, drink a whole bunch of beer.
True.
Yeah, true. I mean, like, I think that's probably the first thing that you would do, you know. But let's back up just a little bit. So that access thing is something that I would never have thought of. The swamp, I can understand that completely. Is it like surrounded by public, and B, is there like, you know, is this in an area where there's a bunch of ag or there's a bunch of food around, so you don't necessarily have to provide that for the deer?
So public is not very close by. It's all private. It's in Jackson County, Michigan. That's a plus, right? We've all heard about that growing up. At least I did. So I wanted to be in the right neighborhood as well. That's a good requirement to put on your list. Make sure you're in a good neighborhood. And then the food was not very close by. Still to this day, the nearest cornfield is probably a mile away. It just becomes a lot of timber, and then it gets down to the swamp. And on the other side, a mile down, it's all fields, all corn. And that's where a lot of my deer are, my bucks especially, most of the year. The bucks that I hunt, they don't come back every year. They're almost always different. I don't know if that's because they're getting shot in Michigan or they're just roamers or what. I don't think they're all roamers. You think some would live there. But they don't show up till they start getting pressured everywhere else. And that's what I've learned. Did I know that at the time? No. I just knew that swamp was nearby and I should have a good wind most of the time for what I want to do. Quick tip, what I've learned is setting up your access on a property should be very important versus how close to a cornfield you are.
Okay. Well, I was just thinking that in terms of like these next questions, because like as sure, you set up if you were set up and there was a swamp, there was your piece of property, there was beans on one side and corn on the other side, like
a different story.
You putting in a food plot might not be like the first thing, or maybe not be that beneficial. You might want to focus on other things. So knowing what you've just laid out now, as you get in there, so what's the first thing that you do after your bonfire? What did you talk about at your bonfire drinking and what you're going to do in the morning?
Well, we probably talked about how many beers we could drink that night and that whole thing. But the very first thing I did was get a skid steer out there with a brush hog and start mowing down, 2 acres for a food plot or a couple food plots. Worst decision I ever did out there, but I didn't know that at the time. And we buzzed it all down. It looked really nice. Food came in great, but got that thing stuck in the mud, sank the skid steer up to the freaking steering wheel and that thing, or the sticks, and had to get a wrecker come out. So I met my neighbors that day by asking them if I can take a wrecker through their property. Don't recommend that either. Got the neighbor's truck stuck, trying to use his truck to pull it out. So that was a different neighbor. So now I'm really making friends. So that's what I did. First thing was cut all the brush down in the area where I could plant, and then plant food. Very first thing. And I have, and like you said, depending on where it's at, food is important. We have to figure out what is the largest need on your property. Every property is different. If I had corn on one side, beans on the other, food would not be as important. I have, that swamp there. So I'm trying to get them to hit that first on the way, because they still go to the corn and beans a mile down the road. They still go that way every night. But at that time, I thought food plot, food plot, food plot, and mowed it all down. And I've spent every minute trying to grow cover back up since then.
Okay. So once you figure that out, let's go through the progression of the whole thing, and then maybe we can go back to if Jared were to do it again.
Sure. Okay. 10-4. So basically I planted, saw, you know, just had a wide open view of everything. I could see a long ways. I've always grown up thinking that, you know, I go in some woods, I get up on a hilltop, look down over a big hill with a rifle in hand, and that's a good spot. So I hunted that way for a couple of years. But the first thing I did that very first year, I learned from a friend of mine, who's been hunting a long time. He said, you know, I don't walk on my property to hunt at all until late October. I'm like, at all? He's like, not one bit. These Michigan deer are crazy. Don't let them know you're hunting them. And so I took that to heart year one, and I didn't hunt my first property that I ever bought that I did all this work on all summer. I didn't hunt it till the 26th of October for the first time. And that night I had an 8-point that I passed, a nice 2-year-old. And then I railed him back in after he left. I was just getting kind of aggressive, trying some stuff out. And I thought, holy crap, what did I, you know, this place is awesome. It's in a good area, blah, blah, blah. We talked about that. But what I learned after that was, okay, low pressure is really helping. So I've hunted it carefully ever since I've owned it. I've never gone willy-nilly out there. So that really hasn't progressed or changed too much. And then, you know, I set up blinds and tree stands and everything everywhere else, and pretty much just thought it was just my Michigan luck, you know, not seeing a buck that I wanted to shoot. So I ended up hunting that first year. My third sit, I shot a 10-point and liver shot it, ran way out in the swamp, and I'm getting a dog, getting it, the whole thing, celebration. But what I did to find that spot where I hung that stand that day, when I first bought the property, I walked around with a notepad and drew on a piece of paper where every deer trail was. And you start to zoom out a little bit and get this picture, this paper, a lot of deer trails sort of zooming in and pinching down right in this one spot. Well, I've killed like every deer but one out of that little pinch right there, or seeing them, or it's just a good spot. That's kind of what I started on, what I relied on for the first couple of years. But I couldn't start timing the bucks. I couldn't catch up with the bucks I wanted to catch up, you know, year two and three. So, you know, shot some does out there. I had a ton of camera pictures, but young kids, I wasn't out there as much, and had some trouble catching up with them, you know?
Sure. And so you did the food plots. You thought, damn, that was a mistake. And you said, now you're doing whitetail 12 months out of the year. January 1st, season's over. What did you do then? First year, second year, et cetera.
Sure. So let me go back real quick. The food plot was a mistake. The only reason, because it was huge, wide open, and a deer can walk out to the edge of it 10 yards in the woods and see all the way across it. See that there's no, you know, a buck could see that there's no other does out there or anything, turn around and head the other way. And they like those types of fields, those cut cornfields. They like that stuff at night in the dark. It's when the bucks that I want to shoot feel safe. So I started learning that. And then I started building cover. I've tried everything from, you know, year one, we started planting willow trees, hybrid willow trees. They grow pretty quick, and try to make some cover. Well, those all died because it wasn't wet enough. I think I have one or two that lived out of like 100. Like I've literally done everything wrong already to learn in the past 5 years. And then we started adding miscanthus grass, which is a grass that grows 10, 12, 15 feet over a couple of years, and had a bunch of that in there. When there were some chainsaws, year one, year two, did some hinge cutting in certain areas, kind of by the road where I parked to block my parking area from the deer. And I realized like year two, year three, that my woods were way too open in the back. So after hunting there a year or two, that progression moved into, okay, I can see across my whole property come November. Even December, you can see all the way across. And deer don't like that. You know, they need security cover. And that's when I started getting the saw out more and dropping trees, hired a logger or a forester, and then did that. That was, I think we finally got the bid in and cut That was last year. So 2020, September 2020, they finally cut my backwoods.
So define that process for me, because I mean, sure. I listened to last year. It was super informative. You had maybe the guy that you used, but you had a forester on the show, and that is super interesting from like a real habitat perspective. But like, so talk about what it is to like hire a forester or the processor or what sure. he is actually doing there.
Sure. Yeah. So depending on what your goals are, my goal was habitat and whitetail. Some people like to grow timber, right? You go up north, a lot of sugar maple and whatnot people grow, or pine stands. Depending on what your goal is, whether it's timber or habitat are usually the two things. Mine was strictly to hold more deer, make better hunting. Always has been. And so he was nice enough to work with me and say, hey, I get that. We can achieve that goal. Your 8 acres is not a very big area back here to get logged. It's wet. And it's already been logged before you bought the property. They took the really big trees out before I bought it. So I knew I wasn't going to make very much money at all. But it was safer than me going in there with a chainsaw and dropping 150 big oak trees. So he came out. We walked the place. He gave me a proposal on kind of what he was going to do, which is pretty much make a prospectus and send it out to different loggers. They have like a, you know, a certain couple of months to bid on it and send me a quote, or send him a quote, I should say. And then we pick one, or the bids came back so low, we waited another year and we sent it out again, came back low again. But then what you do, once you identify the team you're going to go with, then he sets up with that team a plan on how they're going to go in there, which trees they're going to take, how they're going to leave it for you, not going to leave a mess or maybe, you know, a bunch of ruts, and just make sure that you're happy and satisfied when you're done. And then you get paid. He takes his cut and I get mine. And then your woods are, you know, and the loggers take their trees and go bring them to the mill and make more money. So that's how that whole thing is done. That they were in there for a couple of weeks. It was a mess, a lot of noise. But we'll get you in the story later. The deer are using the heck out of it already.
Midway USA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping, MidwayUSA.com.
So it's not a hard thing to do. It's honestly one of the most common issues that I see when we walk properties for our clients. We help out on people's properties, call them our land plans. And honestly, the most common thing I see is an open woods park-like setting where you can see all the way through it. And that's what mine was like, you know? So hindsight being 2020, I should have done that right off the bat. I didn't know. So,
okay. Yeah. So you said you hired a forester. He came in. I stopped you in the middle of the story because I wanted to know like what that process was. Sure. So
help me out here.
Good. So once the forester comes in, you get that all done. Then what? Then how do you proceed from there?
So the way that I had them lay the logging roads out, they created kind of a pinch point. They went into my woods and they split off in three or four different directions. And all I did was say, don't touch the tops, leave the tops of the trees. They take the big pole logs, the valuable ones, and they leave the tops. And I said, just leave the tops and then, you know, haul your stuff out and just use the one road in. And then you can branch out from there when you get in there further. And then, yeah, they were there a couple of weeks right before deer season last year and they were gone. After that, you let Mother Nature take over. You know, you can go in there and clean up some of the areas if you want to cut some trails. You know, if there's a wall of treetops that a deer can't get through, I'll go in there and cut trails through there, manicure it a little bit so they can get around in there. Other than that though, you wait for the sunlight to hit the forest floor and then the regeneration to come up. which creates food, cover, security, everything else. And then those treetops that are laying there, as they biodegrade, they are cover. You know, you take a 50-foot crown on an oak tree and tip it on its side. Well, that's a pretty big brush pile for a year or two before it kind of falls apart, you know? So that, I said, leave the tops, and it's just a mess. It's a mess back there. So what I've done since then, nothing. Let it grow.
And is that the state that it's in right now today?
Yep. Yep. The only thing I did do was I went and threw some clover and stuff down on their logging trails where they drove through, but it's all underwater this year. So none of that survived this year, but last year was really cool looking. You just imagine all these big treetops and brush, and then these green, neon green clover trails winding through them all and around them all. It's pretty beautiful. But this year, yeah, this year it's just, they're kind of, all the leaves have kind of starting to fall off them more. They're starting to fall down a little bit and just degrade, and, or decompose, I should say. And then, yeah, I haven't done anything back there except for stay out of it.
Okay. And so in that, from year one to year five or wherever you're at right now, how have you adjusted your food plot strategy?
So the original food plots that we cut in, parts of those are still there. All I did to fix the big wide open is build cover back in and shape them certain directions. So everybody's property lays out different. Most people want to go put a food plot in because there's an open area. Well, there's sunlight coming down here. This is a field. Let's just plant it here. Well, it's kind of backwards. If you can't get to that spot or get out of that spot without busting deer, say there's a deer in your food plot and you have to walk across it to get to your tree stand, that's counterintuitive, right? It seems simple, but a lot of the times this is what happens. And then, so what I did was pretty much separate my access from the food plot, where if there were deer out there, they can't see me come in and out because I'm back 50 yards over here behind all this brush that I've let grown up. I planted switchgrass, all that, and I'm downwind of them. They have no idea. So that's what I've done. And doing that has resulted in a lot less food. You know, you take an acre and you put half of it back into cover to hide yourself coming in. It may seem counterintuitive again, but at the same time, the deer need that cover. So that's all I've done there, really. And I have extended the food kind of winding down through some cover back towards the woods down there where it was logged. Other than that, food is really, it's a staple. But like you said, there's beans and corn right down the road. So to me, it's important to have it, but I have other fish to fry in terms of priorities at this particular property. Some people, like in Northern Michigan, or maybe the UP where your property is, we're going to talk about that. That might be a bigger hole in the bucket to fill there, where down here, it's like you're just competing with corn and beans. So it all depends on the property. And that's why we show up and walk and tell people, you know, kind of where they should start, at least in this whole marathon we call habitat work, you know?
And so I want to get into your hunts and everything, but I guess for completeness sake, if you were to do it over again, like knowing what you know now, A, would you still buy the same property? And then B, how would you go about setting it up? And would it have taken 5 years to get to the point that it is now? I mean, I would have to assume that no matter what, you plant something, I mean, unless you're buying full-size trees and, you know, a lot of this stuff, some of it just takes time. You know, I don't think you can buy 12-foot mythicanthus and just put it there and say, okay, now I've got my screen. Like, these things take time, right? So how would you go about it? And I guess I would like to look at it from, like, guys that are just starting out or whatever who are saying, like, man, I'm really intrigued by the story. I mean, the guy kills two great bucks in this little piece of property. You know, it's laid out maybe similar to mine, but I don't really know what I'm doing, so I don't want to put a whole lot of money into it. I don't want to, you know, until I can start to see that first little tinge of success or whatever. So kind of like from that perspective, like how would you set your property up? And then like maybe the most cost effective versus time intensive type things.
Yes. So, first things first, for anybody who wants to get into this, I urge you to do so. It's another very passionate, you know, thing that's, it's a lot of fun and rewarding and truly is awesome to shoot deer on your own property that you've turned into something cool. Like there's nothing better I'd rather do than that. You can bring me to Iowa and shoot 180 inch deer. While that would be really cool, I'm super proud of what I did this year. And I urge everybody to try that. And if you need help, great. People can help, but most things grow back. So if time isn't an issue, you can try things and things will grow back. You cut a tree down, trees grow back, take a while. Mow a food plot down, it takes a few years, you can grow cover back. So people should try it if they're interested. But to answer your question, I would still have picked that property. I would have not done a few different things. I would have got the logger in there or the forester in there right off the bat. And that's what we do with our land plan class, just because that's the most common thing I see. I would have planted less food and kept more cover that we mowed down. Easy. You know, those two things right there, would probably knock maybe a year or two off this whole thing in terms of the 5 years. Apple trees. I put those in year one because I know best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago and I still don't have apples. So that hasn't helped me out yet, but that will in a few years, I'm sure. And yeah, that's mainly the main things that I would do different right there. Other than that, I've put so much thought into it that I try to be pretty calculated with my decisions. But that's it. If anything, I could knock down some time on that and maybe have gotten to this point a little sooner. That would have been nice. My whole goal is to buy a piece of property, spend 5 years on it. And by year five, you're either going to know you like it or you're going to know, okay, it's not working out here because of a neighbor or whatever. Then you're going to move on and maybe try something different and sell the property and buy something somewhere else. But that's kind of my plan. I don't think I answered all your question though. Am I missing part of the question there?
Well, I just wanted to say like,
all cost effective stuff.
Yeah.
So I would still buy a high quality seed. I use Killer Food Plots. My friend, Nick Percy, owned that company, just passed away, but he's a high quality seed there. You can use stuff that's more cost effective from grain bins somewhere else. You probably won't get the tonnage or maybe the germination rates that are the same. But you know, if you're just getting out there and starting, use what you can afford. Use something good though. Don't like read the seed tag. A lot of it'll have ryegrass in it and that'll grow and it'll look green and you think you did something right, but it's not really palatable as much of the deer as say oats or clover or something else. I would start out with clover for anybody. That stuff is graze tolerant. It's pretty drought tolerant. So everybody plants these food plots in the fall. And if we don't get any rain, there's a lot of mad food plotters out there. Well, clover does really well and helps birds and bees and turkeys and bugs and everything else, including deer. So I'd recommend that for cost effectiveness. And then sweat equity with a chainsaw. Chainsaw is one of my number one tools. Everybody probably has one. Or if not, you can go get one. And then getting that sunlight to the forest floor is huge. Took me a while to realize like that is the most important thing, but that is the most important thing is letting the sun get down, the natural browse, the natives coming up, just letting Mother Nature do what she does. And don't try to fight it and plan all this other fancy stuff. Just enhance what she's already doing and let that work for you. Don't try to steer the deer 180 degrees the other way. Set up along their corridors and make them steer. You know, this second buck I shot here, he could have walked straight across my food plot that was there 5 years ago. And he would have been at 70 yards the whole time, way out of range. I got him to come up to within 20 yards of my tree stand towards me. And then he was about to go back the other way. It's kind of a big, U shape. Well, I shot him at the tip of the U, and all that was planned, all that. But I learned that. So like, if I would have done that a couple of years ago or year one, instead of mowing it all down and trying to grow it back, maybe I'd see some results a little quicker.
Okay. And then real quick, just because I think this may be something that I know that I have overlooked, and I've heard other people talk about, and I think maybe on your podcast or something, but when you talk about tonnage, and I want to know from like your perspective or whatever, how important is it to like listen or read what the package says and do what it says? So it says like, oh, you're going to cover this much seed, will cover 5 acres. And you're like, well, I only got like a quarter of an acre. I'm going to put all this seed out and I'm going to get way more, you know, more seed is going to be better. I'm going to grow more, right?
Nope. And I've done that, and it's still hard for me to stop turning the spreader and be like, there's a little bit left, just throw it out there. Like it's just in us to just, I paid for it and be not as good next year, just get it out there. But the seeds end up competing with themselves and don't grow as well, and end up like stunting themselves, if you will. So you're actually hurting yourself by doing that. Very important to follow the directions on the seed bag. But more importantly, like we call them exclusion cages. So everybody calls them, you put like a fence, like a 4 foot fence, 5 foot high, set in the middle of your food plot. And then, you know, some people think their clover's not growing or their rye grain is not growing. Then you go out there and you look in that exclusion fence where it's excluded from the rest of the food plot, and the stuff's 8 inches tall, 12 inches tall. Well, your deer are just hammering it. You know, they're keeping it down. So while you might not think, man, I suck at doing this, or man, the soil's crappy, or the seed sucks, you just got a lot of deer. Then you got to hammer some does, right? So there's so many different pieces to the puzzle. And it's a little overwhelming at first, but it's really easy to start slow and just take it breath by breath and step by step. That's what I'd recommend. I definitely read the directions on the seed bag.
Yeah. Just because you said that, I was like, that's something that triggered on me. Like, okay.
I've done it, man.
So
many times.
So the way that this podcast kind of came about is, you know, I was on Jared's podcast last year after I shot my deer, and, yep. You know, he shoots this deer on his property, and I'm like, all right, man, like reciprocate, come on, well, let's talk about it, let's have this conversation. And he's like, okay, cool, I'm going to Wisconsin, he was going to Ohio, we'll have to see what's going on. And then, okay, I'll get with you when I get back from Wisconsin. I get back from Wisconsin, he's got another deer down, and it's like the same deer, like it's like, you know, big, nice, you know, great looking buck. And I'm like, this motherfucker's supposed to be in Ohio. And he's like, oh, went home, shot one on my property again, tagged out in Michigan. I'm like, you have to be kidding me. So like, let's talk about your season here in Michigan and how you started the season and the first deer. We'll go like from that perspective.
Cool. Yeah, no, thank you. So like I mentioned, I have a wife and three kids, and we're trying to get this podcast business off the ground. And then I have my other job, and I like to hunt and, you know, get all the, so time is very limited for me. I already push it enough as it is. And it's like, I hunted one time on an opening day on a 40 acre lease I have up near Fowlerville. I pulled back on a doe, see dark, couldn't find my peep sight, whatever. That hunt was done. I like to shoot a doe off the bat sometimes. Well, I didn't get back out till the 16th of October. It was really hot, as you know, early season. And I was like, you know what? Get some stuff done around the house, put in brownie points, spend time with the kids. And I've been monitoring my trail cameras on this property. This is my fifth season. I really started monitoring them 2 years ago. So it's my third season of really paying attention, in terms of keeping them in the same spot, noticing patterns, that sort of thing. Well, something started to show last year that, okay, the year before you had a bunch of bucks showing up in daylight, not a bunch, one or two in daylight, mid-October, like the 16th, 15th, 14th. I just remember the 15th being mid-October. Everybody calls it the lull. Well, you're this property, whatever that happens then. Normally, we're doing something. So like last year, I'm like, all right, 15th, I'm going hunting. Awesome. Cold front coming in. My wife's like, so is the camper ready to go? Cause, you know, this Halloween weekend thing and at this campground's coming up. I'm like, what? She's like, yeah, we're going camping next weekend. I'm like, oh no. So I botched that. It was a perfect cold front. Again, the pictures were there. It's that annual trail camera, Dad. I'm sure you've covered on the show. Lots of people have, but I've never had it affect me before. It really hasn't. And they're not the same bucks, which a lot of people normally talk about. This is a different deer. But for some reason, that property turns on at that time. Well, this year, I wasn't ignoring it. I wrote on the calendar in like June. I'm like, hunting this weekend, X. And we went camping the weekend before, so it was fine. And I slide out there on an evening hunt on Saturday evening. It was cold. And I hunted a stand kind of up towards the road, towards my vehicle where I park. And it was a good north wind, northwest. Temp dropped from the day before. The rain had just stopped. And we talked about this on our podcast, 149.5, that episode called October Indicators. Like things to make you think that maybe you should get out in the woods. We recorded that on a Friday. No, a Thursday. And then, so I was going hunting that weekend. I told my buddy Jim, I'm like, I'm going out. It looks good. Let's try it. I saw a bunch of deer that night, like 17, I think, on the 15 acres. And I can only see from my tree stand at that spot about two and a half acres. And I passed a couple little bucks. I passed some does, which is hard because I hadn't shot one yet. You know what I'm talking about. And I saw this, I heard this tree getting raked, and I saw a big body deer step out right at dark, further towards my swamp, my 8-acre woods, I call it, where the loggers were last year. And I thought, okay, I should have sat that stand. I'll back out of here and get in there tomorrow morning. Well, I snuck out, no deer heard me, knew I was there, nothing, 17. They kind of move on. Well, the next day is Sunday, the 17th. It's pretty warm. And I decided I'm going back there anyways. And, you know, it was a great day to hang out or barbecue or something like that. I almost called it. I'm like, you know, it's too nice. I'm like, you know, you said you were, just go. And sure enough, I saw some bucks sparring that night. The moon was high in the sky. Some bucks were sparring. It was like 60 degrees. I passed a little 8-point and some does. I moved into where I thought that buck was. And I trimmed a tree for my saddle last year, but I never hunted it. I'm using the Latitude this year as well. I really like that saddle. And my first time using it, I get up there early. It's really windy. And I saw, you know, like I said, saw a couple of small things, this and that. And right at dark, the wind died. And I could just hear it get quiet, very quiet. And I start hearing footsteps from a couple of different directions. And I'm like, all right, here we go. And sure enough, the first thing that popped in was this buck. All I could see were the real nice main beams and G2s and G3s. I'm like, he'll do. You know, I'm not super, super picky. I just want to shoot usually 3-year-olds if I can. And he was big, big bodied. Walked in, he walked right into my food plot, munched on the brassicas real quick, and then walked right to a mock scrape that I had made right in front of me. At like 10 yards. And I'm in my saddle. I'm facing the tree. Well, he's coming in on my weak side. And I'm still trying to learn how to shoot the weak side. So what I did was I stood up and turned all the way around on my little tethered platform and just hugged the tree and then drew back and shot like you're in a tree stand. Mm-hmm. Ended up hitting him, quartering away hard. Sounded like a gut shot. So it's like a real soft, you know, thud instead of a whack. I'm like, oh, no. So he runs out in front of me at 12 o'clock, stands there, walks in another shooting lane, broadside at 20 yards. I shot him like 10 yards. I could not get my arrow out of my quiver and get it on that bow to save my life. I'm shaking, you know, like a leaf in that tree. And he's like looking around like, you know, can hear something. And he starts to go away from me on my neighbors, and I hit him again with a second arrow finally. And he ends up wheeling around to my 3 o'clock. So I shot him at 9, shot him again at 12. He wheels to my 3 o'clock and then starts laying down, standing up, laying down to belabor a long story. He ended up expiring, you know, there, and the woods went silent. And I wasn't sure how I hit him. So I sat there in my saddle in my tree stand for 2 hours in the dark. just listened for any noise, anything for him to get up, never got up. I was on the phone with a dog tracker, and he's like, you know what? You just might want to back out to be safe. You know, it doesn't sound like you know exactly where you hit him. Get the arrow and get out. And that's what I did. And the arrow looked pretty good. He was there the next day, went back there, he's laying right there. And he was actually laying right next to one of those treetops that I talked about earlier in this episode that we left. His second bed was in that bed of the treetop. And then the second time he got up, he stumbled and crashed and died. But there was a deer bed, you know, 50 yards from my tree stand where we put that top there from the loggers and just didn't touch it and let him bed there. So that was kind of cool. And my arrow came in high and back and went through one lung, and then cut the top of the aorta going into the heart, cut that part way, and then came out. So he was dead deer, but it was pretty awesome. Found him the next day, he ended up big 9-point with a split G2, probably 18-inch spread. I don't really score my deer all that much or really care too much. I just like shooting old deer. And he's about 130-inch 8-point little split G2 on there. So I was more than tickled to shoot that buck. And then, you know, so early, being where the 19th of October, that was cool too. You know, a lot of people were in the October lull or whatever you want to say. I obviously had something there that he liked and that he was coming to check or whatever it was, the food plot, the scrape, the whole setup. He felt comfortable there is, I guess, what I'm trying to say. And then I just slid in there as stealthy as I could. So that one worked out.
Yeah, a couple things. One of the questions that came up there is, so you got 15 acres. You talked about multiple blinds and multiple stand sites. You have a known predominant wind. How many stands, let's call all of them stands, sure. Do you have set up, and are they set up for different winds, or how are your locations dispersed throughout the property?
I have 6 that are set up, and they're all set up for a west or a northwest or a north, every one of them. I have 2 other trees that are set up for south or east. But I go in there with a saddle at that time and I climb, and, or, you know, I've used a hang on or whatever in the past, portable tree stand. But 6 hard sets that are there to pick from. I firmly believe in deer pattern us more than we pattern them. So what I tried this year was just being mobile, even among my set stands. Don't hunt a stand more than, you know, once before you move on and throw something totally different at him. You know, don't let him figure it out. I did buck bedded last year under one of my tree stands. I hadn't sat that stand, but he knew where my access was, and I kept using the same access every time. Sure enough, 5 yards off my walking trail. You know, he's big rub, big bed right there. So start thinking about how these bucks bed and what you would do if you were a buck to try to save your butt. All right, well, I know this guy parks over here and walks through here every time, or they might not think exactly like that, but you start to kind of put it together where I have to keep them guessing. So this year I was like, I'm going to hunt mobile in my saddle all over my private property. Screw setting up stands and setting up any more stands. I'm just going to bounce around and be mobile. And I mean, out of all the deer that I've killed that are on the wall, 90% of them are probably first sits in a spot. So it's kind of interesting.
And that kind of transitions into, another thing that I just wanted to mention in there, and it seems kind of, I don't want to say counterintuitive, but it, you know, people talk about the October low, and guys that kill big bucks say bullshit on that. And the reality of it is that these deer don't disappear in the middle of October. But in your situation, and you said, you know, maybe you, you know, you obviously had something there that the deer wanted. Well, those deer had cover and they didn't have anybody pushing them around. So, you know, for us that, you know, don't necessarily have that situation, maybe we can be looking to where aren't these deer being pushed around, or where would they have all the things that they need in mid-October so that they don't have to go where we expect them to be in November, you know, mid-October. If you're hunting your rut funnels or whatever, you know, pinch points on October 15th, you know, those deer probably aren't moving through there, you know, at that time of year. So it just kind of, you know, when you said, you know, the October lull, well, if you don't go in there until mid-October, those deer have been, you know, what, 9 months of, you know, sanctity outside of you going in there and look at this guy, he's cutting down more trees, he's spreading more seed, like, what the heck is this guy doing? You know, he's not, you're not trying to kill him at that point, right?
No, you're exactly right. And a lot of my deer don't show up until, you know, September, October. When I first started, it was end of October, I'd get the first buck I'd shoot out there. This year it was like September 21st. So if you build the habitat, they come earlier, but I'm lucky enough on this property to where they're out in those bean fields all summer long. I'm not pushing deer, cutting trees or planting food plots. They're not there. There might be a doe family or two there, but, whether you're in my situation, whether you're in, you have your own 40 acres and they're there all the time situation, or whether you're on public land, which we talk about, looking for that spot that you mentioned it perfectly, the spot that they have all this stuff, whatever type of area that is, habitat. Dan Infall, he always calls it the red brush, right? That's where he finds this area where there's no pressure, there's browse, there's cover. Wherever you are, if you can find that spot, or in my case, create that spot or not screw up that spot, that's where they're going to be. Because, yeah, you're right. They don't disappear in October and just come back in November. They're there. We just got to not let them know that we're there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you, there was one situation in there that you didn't mention, of all of those things. And one of our Patreons, Jason, he said, ask the habitat guy this question. He's got 40 acres now. His dad does. 25 of it, it sounds like, are like field. So they had 15, like little patchy woods. And he said that the bucks summer there, but when it gets to hunting season time, they're gone. So why would a deer do that? Or is it just pressure? You know, so they're never there. There's never anybody there. Kind of the inverse of what we were talking about, you know, there's never anybody there. And then all of a sudden come hunting season, you're pushing them out. So how do you, would you deal with that kind of situation? From that standpoint, when they're there all summer and then they're gone as soon as you want to hunt them.
That's frustrating. And we've had a lot of our clients talk about that. And what happens there, a couple of different things it could be. It could be what you said there, where the pressure is not there all summer. Then all of a sudden September comes, trail cameras go out, scents all over the place. These older bucks don't have patience for that. They're gone. In other states, maybe you're good, but in our state, they're a little bit schizophrenic, a little crazy. But, and the other thing is summer habitat, like goldenrod and certain tall grasses that are great for cover. As soon as fall gets, you get a frost or two, that stuff starts falling over and gets really low to the ground. It's not the cover that it was in the summer. Leaves fall, crops come out, things change. And that's where, if you're having that, first of all, every property is different. So you want to, you know, get somebody out there and take a look at it and try to see that sort of thing, what exactly it could be. But the main contributors I would say would be pressure, change of habitat in terms of what's there, and then maybe some crops. But like, if so, if it's all switchgrass all summer, that's not going to fall over in October, November. Maybe those bucks will leave, but I'm thinking another buck or two will come in because they, you know, they all shift in September. Some of them do. I think you have to have in Michigan, you have to have the cover. And I'd be curious to see what that patchy woods look like, what that field looks like, et cetera. How much cover is really there? Just because if they had everything they need, they probably wouldn't leave.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to bring that up because you said,
yeah, have him message me. I'd be happy to look at it. You know, I'd be serious. I'd love this stuff. So
perfect. Okay. So then you shoot this deer and you're going to Ohio. And like I said, it was like you didn't even go to Ohio because all of a sudden you shot one here. So when you went to Ohio, how'd that go?
Yeah. After I shot that deer, my wife or some of my family, like, are you done hunting? You got one? I'm like, not quite.
Doesn't work that way. Yeah, try shooting an elk. They're like, oh, you don't need to go hunting at all.
Good call. Maybe I won't go elk hunting next year then. And so I'm on this lease in Ohio with my co-host of the podcast, Brian, and my buddy Corey, and then three other guys. So we have six of us on 130 acres. Kind of a lot. But it's in Muskingum County. It's a great area. There's terrain, and it's Ohio. We're gonna have fun. Brian's got a shipping container. He moved to the property. We turned it into a little cabin. You know, we were down there sleeping. It was like 32 degrees. We woke up inside that thing one morning, but it's all good fun. And so I kind of wrote Michigan off. I said, I'm good here for a little while. I hunted one more morning hunt on my property because I was still getting some good bucks on camera, but it didn't work out. And then I took off right after Halloween. I left November 1st to go down there for a couple of days. I was going to hunt down there the 1st through the 5th and then come back. So went down there. Weather was great. It was cool. There was no wind. So it was very, very quiet. All the leaves were dry. It sounded like a freight train walking through the woods. I think that hurt us. And then it just wasn't on yet. Like there wasn't any rutting activity. We had some bucks daylighting, but they're just walking around. They weren't behind does. It was really just like it hadn't kicked off yet. So I'm sitting there all week having a great time. We're just hanging out. And then I'm just getting daylight picture after daylight picture after daylight picture on my 15 acres going, oh my goodness. You know, what am I going to, I'm going to break the news to these guys and I'm going to leave Ohio and go back to Michigan. Like that sounds stupid. And so we spent a day, I was going to leave the day before that on Wednesday. So I would have been there two full days of hunting at that point. I already knew I was ready to go. But we started insulating the tin can. We call it Camp Tin Can. So I stayed there late. We put all the insulation up and I hunted there that night. And then the next morning again, had a couple small bucks, but nothing crazy. I'm like, all right, well, I'll leave after the morning hunt. I'll drive straight to my property 5 hours away. And then I'll hunt there and then I'll be home, you know, for kids' bedtime and work on Friday. Sure enough, recorded a podcast on the road on the way home about moon phases and this and that. And the dude was like, it's going to be a good day today. I'm like, I hope you're right because I'm heading that way. And I get there about 2:30, get up in the tree. I didn't go back as deep where I shot that other buck because I wanted to be able to see far and maybe call if I had to and call one in if I could. I was over a mock scrape I made that was just tore up. Food plot, pinch point that I created. Like I said before, it was a big open rectangle. Now I made it like a V or a U, if you will. The bottom or the tips of the V are very wide, a lot of food. Then it narrows down a little trail through cover to connect both ends of the V. And right at that tip of that V is where my mock scrape is, my camera, my water hole, my tree stand, my cover to get in. And I got up in that tree about 2:30 and I was looking around and I had 9 rubs within 20 yards of my tree that were not there last year. And I'm thinking, okay, this is a good sign. Something's working through here. The scrape that I made was there. And I look across, way across my other food plot that I mowed down year one as well. And there's a 2-year-old 8-point working a little scrape. And so it's like, all right, bucks are on their feet. That's great news. And then I have cameras all over this thing too, right? So I got a bunch of cell cameras that I monitor without stepping foot on the property. Again, it's the whole pressure thing. It's a really big deal to me. So I get this picture on my camera way back to by where that my first buck died, of a really nice buck, and it's 4:45. It doesn't get dark till 7. And I'm like, huh. Like if I was sitting in my saddle stand that I shot that first 9-point out of, I'd have had an arrow in him by now. Like, it was right there. The wind was good, everything. So I just waited and waited. I'm like, should I call? Should I not call? I know he's right over there. Maybe I should call. You know, all that stuff that starts going through your head when you're excited. And what do you know? He walks up to the edge of that food plot, the tip of that V, that's still pretty big and open. And he stands there and looks around. And you see his rack moving. I'm like, oh, that's a nice deer. And he turns around and walks away. He walked to the edge of that food plot, like I talked about in the beginning of this episode. He looked around, didn't see anything he liked, and walked away. I grunted, nothing. He looked at me a couple of times, but wouldn't come back. I snort wheezed. Again, he stopped and looked, wouldn't come back. I'm like, well, I just threw the kitchen sink at him. He's going to blow out if I do anything else. And it's still early, so maybe there's something else come by. I don't know. Well, the neighbors were to the property north of me putting in cattle in their field that abuts up to my property, and they're banging a fence and their kids are hooting and hollering and this and that. And that deer walked right up towards them through this thicket. I imagine, didn't pay a mind in the world to them. I was kind of bummed. That's what happens on small property. That's why, like, 15 acres, it's one of your negatives there. Your neighbors are right on top of you. And then I saw a couple does come out in that same far food plot about 5:30. And I get another picture off my pinch point camera by the road, right by the road. And it's that buck. And he's coming back onto my property from across the street. Again, this guy's just cruising. And I'm like, he's either going to come down by me, or he's going to, like, he's going to come to the big food plot and work the V that I've been talking about, or he's going to go back to where those does were, start chasing them around, and maybe he'll chase the does over here and I'll get a shot. Well, next thing I know, I look out and he's in the middle of my brassica food plot, just mowing the brassicas. We've been blessed this year with rain. I planted them early. They were big and nice and lush, and I fertilized them afterwards, so they look really good. And he was just out there just mowing. And I thought, okay, if he's in that trail and he sees those does, I'm in trouble. The does are far away from me at this point. 100 yards, he's at like 60 yards to my right. And he's at the tip of the V, needs to come down to the base of it. And I put a wall of cover, of screening. It's an annual screen. That's what I made the V with. The stuff grows 14 feet tall. It's like sorghum mix. It's called Border Patrol. I made that wall, and all he did was he just worked and fed along that wall and said, all right, had enough to eat, and just walked perfectly right along the wall that I planted, right to the scrape at 28 yards, ignored the scrape, walked right by it, and gave me a slightly quartering two shot about 25 yards. I drew back once I knew it was coming, because I knew he's coming this way. If he's already right there, he's committed to coming this way. It's the path of least resistance. He has no idea I'm here. And yeah, I drew back. He walked in front of me, Matt. He wouldn't stop. And I let the arrow go on his shoulder and hit him way back in the liver. And he ran out to where I very first saw him, at the opposite tip of the V, where he came out of the swamp, and bedded down right there. Tipped his head over like he was laying down. Got up with his head, did that 3 times, and then stood up. After like 15 minutes, I'm just freaking out. He walks 10 feet looking like a hurt unit, and then ended up laying down there in bed. And so I snuck out of there too that night. He was dead there in that same spot the next morning. And he was bigger than the other one I shot in terms of mass. He is also a 9-point with a split G2, but he's got like way more blades and way more mass, some cool curvature to his tines. The other one was a pretty clean looking 8-point with a split. This one is all kinds of goofy and weird and nice and beautiful. And yeah, I'm just super blessed and pumped. And that was November 4th. So I drove home from Ohio and got in the tree, and that was that, I guess, you know, just, it's crazy. It's awesome.
So one of the things in there, is a great, I guess, outline of the actual habitat and how you kind of made that happen. Now, I'm going to go out of left field here and say, obviously you're using them and you're, you know, committed, and they were a big part of that hunt. The ethics of cellular trail cameras, and then, the mental side of using cellular trail cameras, just in the sense of like, it could have been really easily, like, you'd have been on your phone, you'd have been farting around, you'd have said, you know, I got to get home to the kids, you know, your wife's texting you or whatever. You didn't know that deer was right up by your truck. You know what I mean? Like, right up by your access. So you have both, like, the benefits, you know, of that, but like, how has that changed the way that you hunt? Or do you think that because it's such a small property, you can use them more effectively, say, than on like a 240 acre property? It doesn't really do me any good to know that they're a quarter a mile away or like whatever. Like, on some level, on 15 acres, like, if you were to rattle right there, like, a deer can hear it if they're on your property, you know?
Yeah. Great, great point. I think that the fact that I don't step on my property to check a camera is the number one and only reason that I use them. I don't rattle too often in Michigan. I think I would have been observant enough on each of those. Well, I mean, the first one I didn't see on camera, but this buck and the second buck, to where I would have been paying attention and seeing him both times, being completely honest, God's honest truth. I do. But I was ready. Correct. Like, I had a step up on. And I think that, yeah, you can be on your phone, you can be taking a nap, you can be doing whatever you want to do. That's just comes down to who you are and your commitment. I'm on my phone all the time. I'm guilty. But when it's November 4th and there's bucks starting to move at 2:30, I mean, you probably shouldn't be on your phone too much. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I was thinking. I had some intel. But he was cruising, and that I think is what was part of his downfall as well. He was either in between does or something. I didn't think I had any pictures of him, but I had one from 2 days before. My neighbor had a couple of them. I think that was part of his downfall as well, because I didn't expect to shoot a buck till, you know, the last hour, let alone 6 o'clock about 5:45, 6 o'clock, an hour before dark. He felt comfortable. He felt comfortable moving through there. He felt comfortable looking for does. He knew I wasn't going to be, you know, walking around right at dark. He knew the neighbors were already doing that. He knew not to go up there. A great compilation of things that kind of all worked out together at that right time. As far as ethics on cellular cameras, that doesn't bother me.
Yeah, no. Well, I use them too. You know, they're available. And, you know, it's one of those things where now that it's available, now that the price has come down, I would think that anybody that runs any sort of trail camera is going to have at least one cell camera. And it's like, as soon as you have one cell camera, you're like, why don't I have all of them as cellular cameras? Kidding. Because I don't want to go back out there and check it and do all this stuff. And, you know, what I've said on here before, and I say it like a lot in jest, but what you were talking about of year over year, like, I knew that October 25th, I was going to start to have cameras up in this public spot where my cell cam is. And I was driving home from Colorado, and it was like, these bucks are showing up there, and there's nothing that I could do about it. But like, realistically, or maybe it was right when I just got home. My wife's like, you're not going hunting because you just have been gone for 11 days.
Yes, sir.
But it's like there's people that I would say were like trail camera enthusiasts, right? So look at all these bucks that I have on camera at 3 a.m. Like, look at this big one. Look at this big one. But they're not doing anything with the information. Or there's guys that are like, have like a spreadsheet and like have mug shots of all these bucks. Like, they might not be named, but this is October 15th last year and this year. And so I know that these things start to happen. And I think with cellular trail cams, you don't have to go out there every 2 weeks or every week or, you know, every time you pass by the camera or whatever to get that information. Now, you know, my personal experience is like, I might not get the best picture, the high res, like whatever, but if you can tell how big a buck is, like if you can see big forks and it's past his ears, like it doesn't really matter at that point because I'm not picking and choosing, you know, like, oh, that one probably is 155 1/4 and I don't shoot them unless they're 160 5/8. Like, no, that's not it. But it was just interesting because, like I said, when you said, oh, he's out there by the road, I'm just thinking of the scenarios. You're like, well, my buck has already walked past me. It's a small property, blah, blah, blah. But the way that you've got it set up and the, I think that in and of itself, like, gives you the confidence to say, you know, it's set up this way for a reason. These deer are going to be here. Like, if you build it, they will come in such a way, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, not trying to be braggadocious or cocky at all, because that's not my personality. But to your point, that my road spot is not bad. It's a good funnel up there. It's a dirt road. The deer cross it like it's not even a road sometimes. And they pass through my property. It's a pass through property. They don't stick around long. And I know that. So I know that, okay, if I sit here long enough, and what I've created around here, something should, at this time of year, something should swing in and maybe I can see him and grunt at him or whatever. And when that didn't work and he came back around, well, he came back around for a reason. I don't know. The neighbor didn't have any does or something and he came back. I'm not positive. I just know that, next thing you know, he's eating that food plot and it's like, okay, well, he likes what's going on here. I know that much. And I know that if he's standing there and starts walking this way, he's going to come right here because of the pinch that I made there. And it's like, does it always work out that perfect? Hell no. But when it does, it's pretty fun.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you can't be like, yeah, it was an okay day. You know, you saw a bunch of different bucks. You got your second deer off your property. You tagged out on your same property. You left what a Michigan guy would say is, you know, one of the bigger buck states or whatever,
yeah.
You know, easy to access, you know, for us. And then to show up, you know, come back and fill your Michigan tag on a deer you would have probably killed down there, you know, is huge. So,
yeah, thank you.
I mean, how did your hunting party react? Because you were trying to figure out how you were going to break it to them that you were going to leave. How did they react when you sent them the photos or whatever?
One guy goes, he goes, what are the violation fees for hunting in Michigan as out of state resident or a non-resident? You know, I could be there tomorrow. I'm like, you know, come on up, buy a tag. I don't think the tags are too expensive. I don't recall, but, and you know, just congratulatory. They understand it. The lease is good. The lease has got a ton of bucks on it. It's going to happen. It wasn't happening at that time. And it's hard for me with my limited time to stick around extra long. If again, those cell cameras are telling me otherwise.
Mm-hmm. I guess I was more asking if they were like surprised or like congratulatory, like that sort of thing.
There's probably an MF-er in there, you know, a couple MF-ers and you know, like, screw that guy.
Like, you were right. You knew it. Like,
Yeah. A couple of them, yeah, you called it, it's right where it was. And it's just fun. It's why we do all this stuff and to have your plan workout after all the years of hard work is great. And it's even, it's cool that it's on 15 acres. It's cool that it's in Michigan. It's cool that I left Ohio to go do it. It's just, it's been a, I'm still celebrating. Like, it's been fun. And to be able to help out, you know, like you on your UP property, and we want to talk about that and things like to go help others. I had a buddy in Ohio sent, we, Brian and I worked on a property down there. He sent me a beautiful 10 point he shot yesterday morning. Another guy got his daughter, her first deer, giant buck on 25 acres in Kentucky, 25 acres. This stuff works. Like, it works. And then to be able to like do it yourself on your own ground is just very rewarding. And I'm blessed and just pumped. Like, you, like it, you can't piss in my Cheerios this season. There's no way.
Yeah. So if anybody wants to reach out to you for like help with habitat work, they want the free information from the podcast, they want, you know, they want to congratulate you, whatever. How do they go about that? What's the best place to reach you?
I appreciate that, Adam. Thank you. We are at habitatpodcast.com. Very simple. It's the name of our podcast. You can find it on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen. That's the best way. We have our podcast up there, 150 something of them. We have some blog posts, we have some videos, Instagram, YouTube, all that stuff too. Giving us some feedback on what you like, what you don't like. And yeah, if you need help on your property, we can do that too. So that's really enjoyable to walk out and walk a farm with somebody and hear their side of the story and then help them. It's awesome. So Habitat Podcast, thank you.
Awesome. I think that's all we got. We can close this one out, Jared, but I do appreciate it. So thanks for being
on. Thank you, brother. Thank you, Adam.
Recording stopped. Five anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV. In Wild Country, rules were not created by man. Don't miss Wild Country, Wednesdays from 7 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Presented by Primos. Speak the language. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.